Welcome to the LexisNexis Workers' Compensation Law Center podcast. Discussions and interviews with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Jonathan Mook of DeMauro Ginsburg on the ADA Amendments Act of 2008.
Did you know? There are LexisNexis community pages for insurance law, products liability and toxic torts, real estate and bankruptcy.
Did you know?
There are LexisNexis community pages for workers' compensation law, environmental and climate change, tax law, emerging issues, and more.
Did you know?
Every LexisNexis community gives you the opportunity to read, listen to, and comment on a wealth of content specific to each practice area.
Did you know?
You can register for free and can access all of our community pages from one central location. Join the LexisNexis communities. www.lexisnexis.com/communities.
In September 2008, President George W. Bush signed into law the ADA Amendments Act of 2008, the first significant change to the original Americans with Disabilities Act, which was passed in 1990. The new legislation redefines some of the key terms of the ADA and reverses a trend toward narrow construction of statutory coverage that began with a trio of Supreme Court decisions in 1999. To discuss some of the changes in the Act and what has happened since is Jonathan Mook. Mr. Mook is a partner with DeMauro Ginsburg, PC in Alexandria, Virginia, where his practice includes general litigation and counseling employers in all aspects of employment law. Mr. Mook is the author of two legal treatises on the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, Employee Rights and Employer Obligations, and ADA, Public Accommodations and Commercial Facilities, both published by LexisNexis Matthew Bender. Mr. Mook, first, thank you for being part of this LexisNexis podcast.
I certainly appreciate it.
What are some of the most important changes in the ADA Amendments Act?
I guess that you could maybe three major changes that we will be seeing in terms of the statute. The first, under the ADA Amendments Act, the definition of disability is going to be construed broadly, and that would include the existing language under the definition of disability will now get a broad construction under the legislative history and the purposes and findings of the statute. The second is that the statute explicitly excludes the consideration of mitigating measures such as medication, prosthetic devices, etc., in determining whether or not an individual with a physical or mental impairment has an impairment that would substantially limit a major life activity that would rise to the level of a disability. And the third major change in the statute is that there is a change in the regarded as language for the definition of disability. So you have an expanded scope of persons that may be regarded as disabled under the statute. And I can talk a little bit more specifically about those changes and drill down a little bit in terms of the broader definition of disability under the ADA Amendments Act. As most people probably know, the original ADA as passed has a three-part or three-prong definition of disability. One could have an actual disability, which would be a physical or mental impairment which substantially limits a major life activity. And the language of that requirement for an actual disability isn't changed by the ADA Amendments Act. Just the interpretation of that now is going to be broader. The second aspect of the definition of disability, or the second prong, is whether or not someone has a record of a disability. And the third prong of the ADA definition of disability is the regarded as prong. And in that third prong, the ADA Amendments Act does make a change in the definition, the statutory definition of regarded as. So under the ADA Amendments Act, a person will be regarded as having a disability if an individual is regarded as having a real or perceived impairment and an employer takes a job action because of that real or perceived impairment. There is no requirement that the impairment be substantially limiting, as had been the requirement under the prior interpretations of the ADA definition of disability. So this legislative change under the ADA Amendments Act is going to more broadly sweep in individuals will now be covered under the regarded as prong of the ADA definition of disability if an employer takes any type of an adverse job action due to an actual or perceived impairment of the person, and as I said, whether or not that impairment is substantially limiting any major life activity. And the only caveat to that broad sweep of the regarded as prong of the definition of disability is that the impairment must have an actual or expected duration of more than 6 months. So any time an employer takes a job action against a person because of an actual or perceived impairment that's going to last more than 6 months, that individual is going to be deemed to be regarded as disabled. But the exception would be certainly if an employer would take a job action against somebody because they have a cold or regular flu or a broken leg or something like that. That would unlikely last more than 6 months, so the regarded as prong of the ADA definition of disability would not come into play. So those are sort of the major changes in the ADA definition of disability set forth in the ADA Amendments Act. And there's some other additional changes in the statute, and let me kind of drill down a little bit with those.
Okay.
As I said, initially, the ADA Amendments Act sets forth the rule that mitigating measures no longer will be considered in determining whether or not somebody has an actual disability. In the past, if an individual, let's say, was taking medication for a high blood pressure, with the medication, that person's blood pressure was under control. As a result, that individual could perform daily life activities with not very much of a problem. That person would not be deemed disabled under the statute because you take into effect the mitigating measure, in this case medication. Now, under the ADA Amendments Act, you don't take into account mitigating measures. You assess the individual without the medication. So what's going to happen to this person who's got high blood pressure if he or she doesn't take the medication? Well, for many individuals, that's going to result in severe health problems that would arise. And as a result, that individual, without the use of mitigating measures, medication, would be substantially limited in a major life activity. So with respect to the individual who has high blood pressure, takes medication, is fine. Without medication, that person is going to have some severe physical problems that would substantially limit a major life activity. Now that individual is going to be covered under the ADA as having an actual disability. So that's a very significant and major change that the ADA Amendments Act has put into place in terms of assessing whether or not somebody has an actual disability. That's the case even though the specific definition of having an actual disability hasn't changed. The analysis for whether or not somebody has an actual disability does change because now no longer does one take into account the mitigating measures.
Obviously a much broader analysis than before. But why did Congress believe that these changes were necessary?
What had happened in the last 10 years or so, and let me just go back to what caused this perceived need by Congress for the ADA Amendments Act. Back in 1999, there were a trio of Supreme Court decisions. The lead case was Sutton versus United Airlines. And in that case, the Supreme Court set forth the rule that mitigating measures were to be taken into account in determining whether or not someone had an actual disability under the ADA. And the Supreme Court also took the position that in determining whether or not an individual was regarded as disabled, the employer would need to regard the impairment that the individual had as substantially limiting a major life activity. And additionally, the Supreme Court took the position that the definition of disability should be narrowly and strictly construed rather than to have a broad interpretation of the statutory definition. These trio of Supreme Court cases, which was followed by another Supreme Court case in 2002, it was Toyota versus Williams, led to the courts interpreting the ADA in this strict fashion for determining whether or not someone was disabled and using mitigating measures in assessing whether or not someone would be substantially limited in a major life activity. So those Supreme Court decisions and the impact of those decisions, as I said, very much constricted who could claim protections under the ADA. And many individuals in the disability rights movement and in Congress believe that these Supreme Court decisions created what might be called a catch-22. In other words, in order to come within this strict and narrow definition of disability, a person would need to be so impaired that that individual would, in all likelihood, not easily be able to work, even with any type of reasonable accommodation. So in other words, in order to become disabled under the ADA, you in essence had to be so impaired that even with a reasonable accommodation, you couldn't do the job. That's the catch-22 that many disability rights advocates saw as a fallout from these Supreme Court decisions. So in order to sort of write the proper interpretation of the ADA, there has been a movement in Congress since approximately 2006 to amend the statute, to go back to an interpretation, a broader interpretation of the ADA before these Supreme Court decisions in 1999 and 2002, and to put into place a statutory scheme that would lead to a broader definition of persons with disabilities and eliminate this catch-22 that many people saw had been put into place as a result of these Supreme Court decisions. So that's really sort of what led Congress in terms of moving to amend the ADA. Up until recently, many employer groups had opposed any move to amend the ADA because they were concerned that if the statute were broadened, and particularly if broadened too greatly, that this would certainly create an undue burden for employers having to deal with persons with relatively minor impairments claiming protections under the statute and needing reasonable accommodations. So what occurred basically in the spring of this year was a coalition between disability rights groups, employer groups, interested individuals in Congress, both in the Senate and the House of Representatives, to try to forge a compromise that employer groups could live with and disability rights groups could live with. And this is what resulted in today what we call the ADA Amendments Act. One final note, I believe that many employer groups were concerned that if a compromise were not reached this year, that with the advent of a Democratic administration and a Democratic-controlled Congress, that even broader changes to the ADA might be put into effect if there was a delay in enacting some type of legislative change to the statute this year. So the compromise was struck and the legislation was put on the fast track and signed by President Bush on September 25th of this year.
Are there issues that are left unanswered by the new legislation?
Well, there are a number of very important issues that remain left to be addressed. And as I mentioned earlier, the legislative findings and the purposes set forth by Congress in the ADA Amendments Act indicate that the existing statutory definition of disability is to be broadly construed and that the limitations that had been imposed by the Supreme Court and also by the EEOC in its regulations in terms of the definition of substantially limits a major life activity should be altered, and that a broader and more encompassing definition of substantially limits should be followed. Now, Congress didn't specifically set forth what this new broader interpretation of substantially limits should be. Congress left this up to the EEOC to address in regulations that Congress charged EEOC with promulgating. So that's the big unanswered question at this point in time. How broadly will the EEOC define the term substantially limits in the context of a major life activity? So that's the great unknown at this point. Clearly, the existing regulations by the EEOC, which treat substantially limiting as being one that has a significant and significant restriction on major life activities, that no longer is going to be the rule, but we don't know at this point how much broader the regulatory definition is going to be.
With the act taking effect January 1st, 2009, what are some of the major challenges employers are going to face in dealing with the new ADA legislation?
Well, at this point, I think employers can expect that with the passage of the statute, there are going to be a lot more requests for accommodation in the workplace. The word has gotten out that the ADA has been amended and to be interpreted more broadly. So I think we're going to see more requests for accommodation by individuals who claim to have disabilities. Also, as I mentioned, because of the statutory changes of the ADA, the strict, narrow interpretation of who's disabled no longer is going to be the case. So many more individuals now are going to be actually disabled under the new ADA definition of disability. So employers are now going to have more stringent legal obligations to accommodate individuals with disabilities under this broader definition. So the shift is going to change now for employers from maybe considering whether or not someone has a ADA disability to how am I going to accommodate persons who are going to be deemed disabled under this broader definition of disability. So at this point, I think a lot of employers need to go back and sort of dust off their ADA reasonable accommodation policies, make sure that those policies are being followed by managers, train managers about how to deal with requests for accommodation. Employers are going to need to start thinking about if a request for an accommodation is made, what type of procedures are going to be put in place to deal with that request, and how are employers going to get information in order to help accommodate individuals with disabilities who are requesting accommodations in the workplace.
Are there some specific things employers can do now to prepare for the new statutory changes?
Well, I think a couple things. One is employers need to look, as I said, at all their personnel policies, including ADA policies on reasonable accommodation, and make sure that they have in place a system to address those requests. Second of all, employers need to have a system in place so that if an individual with a physical or mental impairment wants an accommodation, says they're disabled, the employer has a procedure whereby they could consult with a medical consultant to know what type of request for medical information an employer may ask of an employee to ensure that that employee does have a impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. As I said before, now mitigating measures aren't to be taken into account in determining whether or not an individual has a disability. So an employer may not know just from dealing with an employee whether or not that employee now may be covered under the Act. In the example that I gave earlier of an individual with high blood pressure who takes medication, that individual may request an accommodation in order to better perform the job or to be able to perform the essential functions of the job. The employer may not know from just observation whether or not that person could be deemed disabled under the statute. So an employer would need to make a request of that individual for that individual's medical information in order to determine, let's say, whether that high blood pressure without the use of medication would substantially limit a major life activity. Now, most employers and, by the way, attorneys, we're not doctors. We don't really know specifically what medical information to request or how to evaluate that information. So I think employers are well advised to have a consultant that they can turn to when issues arise about whether or not someone is disabled. A medical consultant can advise an employer as to what types of information to request of an employee and also how to evaluate information that may come back. Also, in terms of making decisions about whether or not, let's say, an employee who has a physical or mental impairment can perform certain job functions, and an employer is basing that type of a decision on the basis of a job description, employers are going to need to make sure that those job descriptions accurately describe the functions of the job and that those functions that are set forth on a job description are ones that are actually performed. Because now with more individuals who may be considered disabled under the ADA and may mount legal challenges to employers' decision-making, an employer's determination that due to a, just say, a job applicant's physical impairment, that person can't perform the essential functions of the job, now it's more likely that employers are going to be challenged about that decision and are going to have to justify the job description that they used in order to make an employment decision actually does reflect how jobs are actually performed. So employers need to go back, take a look through their job descriptions, make sure that they are accurate and current. And I think the final thing, as I mentioned about this rise in requests for reasonable accommodation by individuals who may claim that they have a disability, I think it's very important now for employers to have maybe one or at most two individuals within the HR organization who are going to deal with requests for accommodation so that you have a central decision-making procedure within an employer's HR organization on accommodation requests. It is not advisable to have accommodation requests dealt with on an ad hoc basis by supervisors or even first or second tier managers. There needs to be a centralized decision-making process so that there is uniformity and consistency in dealing with requests for accommodation that will be coming from individuals who claim to be disabled under the broader definition of disability.
The EEOC voted on proposed regulations in December to implement the ADA Amendments Act. What happened at that vote?
Well, since August of this year, the EEOC has been looking at amending the regulations on the ADA with the thought that Congress would be passing some type of legislation, which it, in fact, it did, which became the ADA Amendments Act. As I mentioned earlier, the effective date is January 1st, 2009. So at least two of the commissioners of the EEOC, there's now a four-member commission, two of the commissioners were interested in going forward with either putting in place an interim rule or to promulgate an advance notice of proposed rulemaking before January 1st in order to give employers and the public information as to the type of regulations that the EEOC was looking to promulgate in final form. On December 11th, the commission held an open meeting to discuss implementing a advance notice of proposed rulemaking for meeting the January 1st, 2009 deadline. That proposal did not pass because two commissioners voted in favor of going forward with an advance notice of proposed rulemaking. They happened to be the Republican members of the EEOC Two commissioners voted against it. They happened to be the Democratic commissioners on the EEOC. So you had a deadlock, and as a result of this deadlock, no advance notice of proposed rulemaking was promulgated. So the EEOC, because of this deadlock, is now going to wait until after the new administration comes in. We may well get an appointment now for the fifth member of the commission with the new Obama administration, and the new commission will now address the anticipated new regulations that will be promulgated to reflect the ADA Amendments Act. So we're still in a holding pattern with the EEOC in order to know precisely what the EEOC is going to do with respect to amending its regulations to incorporate this new broader standard for disability that is set forth in the ADA Amendments Act.
So there's still quite a bit to look forward to as far as that is concerned.
That's for sure.
And employers have a number of challenges ahead of them as well.
No doubt about it. We are in many ways back to 1992 when the ADA first took effect, and employers needed to start addressing requests for accommodation by individuals with disabilities in the workplace. And there were a lot of unknowns about how to handle ADA requests for accommodation. I think in some ways we're back to the future in dealing with that due to this new expanded definition of disability under the ADA Amendments Act.
That's a good way of putting it. Mr. Mook, thank you very much for your analysis and insights into this area. We appreciate you taking time to be part of this LexisNexis podcast.
Well, I greatly appreciate the opportunity, particularly about this very interesting evolving statute.
Jonathan Mook of Demora Ginsburg on the ADA Amendments Act of 2008. This has been the LexisNexis Workers' Compensation Law Center podcast. Copyright 2008 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated. Visit the Workers' Compensation Center and all the community centers at www.lexisnexis.com/communities. LexisNexis, Total Practice Solutions. I'm Steve Bursler. Thank you for listening.